Hello, welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest for this week's podcast is Rudy Rasmus. From Rudy's previous life of owning and operating what he called a borderline bordello, today he co-pastors St. John's United Methodist Church located in downtown Houston with his wife Juanita, which began with 9 existing members in 1992 and today has grown to over 9,000 members, 30% of whom were formerly homeless, in 21 years into one of the most culturally diverse congregations in the country. If there's such a thing as a Renaissance pastor, I think that fits Rudy. He has a weekly show on Sirius XM. He's the author of several books, was a former columnist in O Magazine, and he just opened a coffee shop in Houston. And, oh yeah, if you Google his name, it won't take long before you see that he's also known as Beyonce's pastor. Rudy really opens up a lot and shares from his own heart, which he's known for, and so I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. I do need to make a note about the background noise. This was the very first interview that I recorded for this podcast, and because Rudy's a busy man, he was doing this from a coffee shop, so you'll hear some background noise when he speaks, and also the audio levels when I was speaking were really pretty bad. So I went back and recorded again some of the questions I asked him. So it may sound a little bit choppy, but I hope you'll stick with it. I think it's worth listening to. Rudy is a great interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Well, Rudy, thank you again for joining me for this podcast. I was wondering if you wouldn't mind jumping in and just sharing a bit about any failure stories that come to mind for you when you, as you reflect on your own ministry.
I have two moments that I think would be sort of insightful for this conversation. One was opening a second campus that was completely incongruent with my overall ethos, my church's culture. And I think I was thinking more real estate than I was kingdom. Mm-hmm. when I did it 4 years ago, we took on a second campus. You know, I've been watching you guys do it successfully. you know,
yeah.
around Chicago, and I'm telling you, man, it's just we took on this campus. What I didn't think about was the neighborhood that we took it on in was completely incongruent with who I am as a person, with our church's culture. It was a location that just didn't fit, and it has proven out to be one of the probably one of the most difficult challenges we have faced as a church over the last 4 years. Second thing, we could talk about both of these today. Second thing was we started building housing for homeless people, apartment buildings in the downtown area, about 7 years ago. Successfully completed the first one. The second one was a big project, $10 million. 80 units in downtown Houston, and that particular project, Christian, almost cost us our entire ministry. We just finished it in December with an extra $4 million, unexpected $4 million, and an extra 2 years of construction time. So when we think about how failure looks, both of those failures challenged me to my absolute core, confronted me with you know what is often ego motivation, you know, in and around. You know, we think about why we do what we do, and when we're ultimately, when we tell the truth, a lot of why we do what we do is because we are, well, in my particular case, I've been in therapy for a long time, 32 years, and and the crisis that both of these projects caused confronted me with one aspect of my overall being, and that is, for most of my life, I have instead of as a survival technique tool, my entire life I have been running effectively away from failure. You know, and I mean really running from failure. So most of the successes I've experienced over the over the years have not been because I necessarily set out to be successful, but they primarily happen because I set out to not fail. You know, and in this huge crisis that I faced on almost losing land, buildings, the church, because everything was leveraged for this housing project. Coming to that moment where I was completely incapacitated by the fear of failing, ultimately, just kind of caved in. Had a probably my darkest moment in the midst of failure as well. Was in the same time frame, September 30th, actually, this past September 30th. And it was probably the first time, man, in my whole life that I'd ever thought, what if I disappeared? You know, and you know, what would happen if I disappeared and not really reconciling the fact that my thoughts around disappearance were really my thoughts around dying to keep from living through this object failure. And in that, you know, that day, man, I ended up with my therapist on a sort of an emergency call, an emergency appointment, and in sitting down with her, she knows me well. She's actually my entire family's therapist, my daughters and my wife. She said, you know, Rudy, I have known you a long time, and I've known you to be an effective leader. You have done a lot of good stuff, but I've never seen you running towards success. I've always seen you running away from failure. And when that light bulb came on, when that light bulb came on, Christian, I really, from that point, from September forward, I have been consciously moving in the direction of not success in a one more notch on the post, but probably for the first time, living into what I mentioned earlier, and that is thinking about what's really important for today. You know, so that kind of sets the framework. We can move through both of those experiences and anything else we've got. I got a lot of, you know, we have been 25 years in ministry, 25 years in the middle of the poorest demographic in Houston. And when I think about how really God has kept us in business over these years with a congregation that's literally incapable of supporting financially the ongoing work. You know, we have done a lot of creative financing. And sometimes, you know, you get close to the edge, and sometimes you almost fall over.
Yeah.
And we've fallen over a couple of times.
Rudy, you mentioned earlier that what has been motivating for you has been running away from failure as opposed to running towards success. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what failure has represented for you.
You know, so I grew up in Houston, Texas. And I grew up in a Houston that was racially polarized, that was economically polarized as well. So, you know, I'm a kid growing up in a town drinking from a colored water fountain. Mm-hmm. And whereas I never fully understood the necessity of that demarcation, I was always focused on not experiencing, if you know, for the lack of a better word, I was always focused on escaping the poverty of my neighborhood. And fortunately, it's the craziest thing, but from the time I was 12 years old, there were opportunities put in front of me that literally helped me to escape the poverty of my childhood. Mm-hmm. Along the way, I realized I began to focus more on not experiencing what my peers in my childhood community had experienced, and the way I could do that would be to move as fast as I could. It doesn't mean I always did the right thing, and, I didn't always do the lawful thing as a young person coming up, but my goal was to make sure that I didn't have the same economic experience of many of my peers and colleagues. Mm. So what it shaped in and around me, Christian, was a I became the quintessential hustler. Mm-hmm. I honed my craft, whatever that craft was at the time, and I always focused on making sure it was the biggest and the best. And I guess when I ended up in church, you know, as a pastor, it was really, I had a new goal. My new goal now was to bring as many people to Jesus as I could. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, that was the prayer my wife had prayed for me for 5 years while I was contemplating Christianity. And so ultimately becoming a pastor, you know, whereas making money had been my goal prior to ministry, as the ultimate escape from failure. Now my ultimate escape from failure was to bring as many people to Jesus as I could, because knowing that the more people I brought to Jesus, the more successful we would be overall, and the less likely to come anywhere near failure would be the story.
You talked earlier about economic motivation, and I think what also I really resonate with is something that you mentioned, ego motivation. I know for me, whenever I think about failure, I think about if I don't do something well, that will make me look bad. And sometimes for pastors, there's the not wanting self to look bad, but also there may be a sense of disappointing God. I'm wondering if either of those was part of your own struggle with accepting failure too.
I never really thought a lot about disappointing God. Primarily because I always felt that me turning the corner and being a part of God's organization was redemption. So I thought more in terms of I guess not experiencing well, I'll tell you, when I did ultimately come face to face with object failure, I realized how much of my identity and self-worth I had attached to success. And you know, whenever you attach identity and self worth to an intangible, then you're really kind of setting yourself up for some difficult moments anyway.
Yeah.
You know, so when I think about both projects, both stretch me in two different directions towards confronting my object fear of failing. On the church side, we started this church. We actually picked up the campus from the conference, launched a service there, and I did probably one of the the dumbest things I've ever done as relates to church. Jose got sneezing. At this particular campus, we started our first service on Saturday morning. And what possessed me to start a strategic worship service on Saturday morning? I was reflecting on it, and I really started on Saturday, started the service on Saturday morning at 11 o'clock a.m. because I was tired and relatively tired of church and didn't want to add one more thing on Sunday. Wasn't really thinking about the fact that nobody really goes to church on Saturday morning.
Right.
You know, so we start the service. Then, instead of bailing in 12 months when it never lifted off the ground, instead of bailing on that 11 o'clock a.m. Saturday morning time slot, I dug in. And for the next probably 16 months, we continued to push forward. And even though I burned out three young pastors in the process of launching that, or trying to get that campus off the ground, it dawned on me that I hadn't really thought about the three young pastors that I burned out. Pushing hard, and ultimately got to the point where the $20,000 a month we were sending to that campus to subsidize its operations completely crippled our downtown campus. It wasn't until that point that I said, hey, I guess we're going to have to go to Sunday.
Did you have people around you who could tell you truthfully, say, after 12 months, Pastor, it's time to do something else? And if you did have people like that, why didn't you listen to them?
Well, you'll find, you already probably know this, but a lot of A-type leaders are often naked emperors. And you're familiar with the fable of the emperor with no clothes? Yeah. Everybody knew the emperor was naked, but nobody really wanted to tell the emperor. Man, you are naked. Because the emperor's got power.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so yeah, I had a couple of folks saying, man, look here, this ain't working. But for the most part, people have historically been relatively reluctant to confront me.
Yeah.
You know, when I reflect on 25 years of leadership, Christian, I'm often reminded as to, matter of fact, in recent months, I have been sort of conducting a series of conversations with young men and women who have been in and around my leadership over the years. And one particular young leader who started out with me when he was probably 14 years old, and now he's 33, told me one day, back in, where are we right now? This is March, April. Back in February, March, we were sitting down talking one day. And he just, you know, he told me, he said, you know, Rudy, you're an asshole. You know? He said, yeah, man. And then he began to chronicle the times. He worked with me for about 10 years. Began to chronicle the times when I was impossible to work with as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Now in this, so I'm at a point now where I'm not trying to grow something. I'm not trying to build something. Probably for the first time in a long time that I am I'm completely okay with just showing up, and some days don't even feel like doing that. It's dawned on me that I'm just now at a point in my evolution that I'm able to confront the fact that I have been probably a very hard person to work with. Yeah. And all of that, you know, when I reflect on it, all of it has been connected to, you know, going back to just connected to my reluctance to contemplate failure.
So in looking back, when you've had people tell you metaphorically you're not wearing any clothes, and also some of the things that you went through, major disappointments, and then last September when you were at your lowest, are you able to go back now and say, you know, actually all of this made me a better human, or are you still struggling with dealing with failure?
Well, no, I think better human is the goal right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am, you know, finally have come to a place where I guess I'm feeling less and less inclined for the need to fight. You know, also as I look back, I realized I have been fighting for my place in the world since I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not really gifted specifically in any one thing. I was an average student with a lot of hustle. Have always felt marginalized and on the outside looking in. And when I think about the at what point in my life I decided that that I will not be overtaken. I will not be marginalized. I will not be minimalized. I would not be defeated. In those moments, you know, you make decisions as to what kind of person you're going to be as you make sure those things don't happen. And I think, you know, as I look back, I have probably, you know, people are really cool with me. They people obviously love to hang out with me, but the people who work closest with me have, I think, have in many cases at times suffered.
You've been in ministry with such a wide variety of people with different backgrounds, from the many folks experiencing homelessness who come to St. John's to Beyonce and everyone in between. I'm wondering if, in your experience, regardless of someone's background, does everyone kind of have that sense of I'm fighting for my place in the world, or does it depend on a person's background as to whether they feel and experience those things?
I think a common denominator for people who have come my way, we've had about 22,000 people join the church over the last 25 years.
Mm.
And you know, whereas it's been a very transient community, a lot of movement, you know, we maintain about 6,000 givers. That's how we actually count participation by people who give.
Financially, you mean?
Financially.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's about 6,000 unduplicated givers in a typical year. But when we break, start moving into that metric, we'll find that 5,000 of the 6,000 give less than $100 a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we kind of dig down into it a little deeper. We typically find that there's a common theme amongst all 22,000 people who have connected with us over these years. And that is, they have mostly been people who have been in the struggle,
mm-hmm.
in the struggle for survival, in the struggle for life, in the struggle for meaning and success, even from Beyonce to the homeless person
mm-hmm.
who sleeps out on the back of the building.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we haven't attracted over the years for the most part. Of those 22,000 folk who joined this church in 25 years, fewer than probably 4% have been white.
Mm-hmm.
It's a if we look at the overall demographic, 90% are unmarried, 60% have been female, 40% have been male. If we drill down even further, fewer than 10% have been corporately employed. You know, when we look at our overall demographic, about 30% have been somewhat enfranchised economically. But that means 60%, you know, have been economically marginalized. So overall, we've got a group of people who, for the most part, have all struggled for survival.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that struggle, the one attraction that I think all of those folk have had as it relates to me is that they have seen me as a person who is also struggling for that same survival.
Yeah, and surviving in more ways than one, surviving not only for the material things that you need, but also surviving in a sense emotionally and spiritually so that you have a sense of who you are.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that show Cheers, where you walk into this place and everybody knows your name.
Yeah.
What we have tendency to do is diminish how important having a sense of place really has in the overall aspect of a complete life.
Yeah.
You know, one thing all of those folk have probably experienced at St. John's is being valued regardless to their socioeconomic station in life.
Yeah.
So, you know, take my phone, for instance. There are 3,600 contacts on my phone. And when I think about those 3,600 people who have my phone number, the reality is all of those folk have a place they know in my life and heart. And I think, you know, if I really went through my phone and looked at the demographic and really, you know, look critically at who these 3,600 people are, it would be people, for the most part, who are just like me, you know, wanting to know my life has significance.
Yeah.
You know, wanting to know that I matter to somebody else.
Right.
You know, and I think when I think about success today, I'm reminded today like I probably haven't been reminded, like I probably haven't reminded myself in the past, and that is, you know, a lot of shit don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of shit that I thought mattered, Christian, just, you know, over these years, you know, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What really matters is that you have I'll put it in Jesus' terms. That you love God with all your heart, mind, soul, strength, and love the person in front of you in the same fashion that you want to be loved.
When you were talking earlier about what you went through last September, about your darkest moment then, is that something that you probably have always known, but coming through what you did, has that made it come home even more so for you?
You know, it all crashed in on me that day.
Yeah.
And so when you think about the prospect of your life ending, I think it puts in perspective, you know, what really does matter moving forward.
Yeah.
So that particular day, I thought, you know, if my life ended today, it would be okay.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, fortunately, my life didn't end that day. But what I also realized is that it doesn't always turn out that well. People who experienced failure and haven't reconciled at that point in their lives what's really important.
Yeah.
You know, so what I would say is the cure to failing is knowing that that one's life is more significant than the objective being accomplished.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Well, what's really important is that one's life reflects and is representative of the character of God, and that is love.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of my chapters of the book is around once people really grasp one's belovedness and really let that hit home and sink in and become the foundation of their life, that makes it so much easier to take risks. And because when you do that, failure is going to happen. But if you're able to lean back on that foundation, which is a lot easier said than felt, then that helps you to take all kinds of chances.
It does.
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, even as it relates to the coffee shop.
Yeah, one of the chapters in my book is around belovedness and how hard it is sometimes to really embrace belovedness. But I think when you do, when you really get a sense of that seemingly simple but profound truth, then I believe that frees you to be able to risk and take chances knowing that you're not defined by those risks, but you're still just defined by your belovedness.
It does.
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, even as it relates to the coffee shop, you know, I know right now the reason I didn't open that coffee shop, I didn't know it at the time, but the reason I didn't open the coffee shop when I originally was scheduled to open the coffee shop is because I didn't know then what I know now about shit just not mattering.
Yeah.
You know, like I told my young colleagues, who are all 22 years old, all four, five of them, I said, look, gang, you know, it's not really important that that this business is booming. What's really important is that we're having fun.
Yeah.
And enjoying and experiencing one another while we make coffee to change the world.
Yeah.
And when I reflect on who they are, they're all young men and women who did not have any obvious breaks in life. And this is their break in life. This is their opportunity. They run this shop like they own it, because they know this is their shot in life and in the world. But I'm reminding them as a 61-year-old that your shot in the world is really to live the best day you can live.
Yeah.
Every day.
Well, that's a really good word to end on. Rudy, I want to thank you once again for taking time out of your really busy schedule to speak with me. I'm grateful for you, for your ministry, and for the thousands of lives that you've touched and continue to touch. So thank you again.
Oh, hey, man, right on. And I'm here with you. And I've always respected your work and you too. And really glad our paths crossed in the world.
Thanks again to Rudy Rasmus for taking the time to speak with me. If you would like to learn more about Rudy and the many things that he's doing, including buying one of his books, you can go to his website, pastorrudy.net. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast. Next episode, I'm speaking with Jody Winteroff. Jody is the Senior Vice President for Policy and Political Affairs for Human Rights Campaign and shares a lot about the ins and outs of Washington and the various political campaigns that she's worked on, including the Hillary Clinton campaign in Iowa in 2008. If you'd like to learn more about me, my book, and my ministry, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com. Thanks again for listening.